Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with Fallen Woman. A weekly psychic fusion of forward thoughts, far-out ideas, magical foray, and spellbinding song. Stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.
When I, like you, was born, I donned a spacesuit for living on this plane. And it was this body. This is my spacesuit. And it had a steering mechanism, my prefrontal lobes, and all the brain motors coordinating stuff. And just like those Rusty Schweigert and the others that go to the moon and they wear their uniforms and they learn how to grab things and lift things. So I did that. You know, I learned my prehensile capacities. And I got rewarded. You get little stars and kisses and all kinds of things when you learn how to use your spacesuit. And you get really good at it. You get so good at using your spacesuit that you can't differentiate yourself from your spacesuit anymore. You think you're your spacesuit. And everybody comes up and says, what a nice suit. See? And you're constantly looking into other people's eyes to find out if you're really wearing a nice spacesuit. It's what I call somebody training. When you're born, you go into somebody training because your parents know who they are and they're going to make you somebody too. My parents were very intent on making me somebody. They wanted me to achieve, be responsible, be healthy, be successful, bring pride to them. And if it didn't interfere with any of those, I should be happy. The problem that I experienced, though, was that the suit that I was wearing, it was like you're in one of these suits that doesn't quite fit and you're a little uncomfortable and you're constantly trying to readjust yourself. The suit didn't fit, but everybody kept saying, beautiful suit, really impressive suit. You must be very happy. But I wasn't. Now, if everybody you look into their eyes and they tell you you're happy and you're not, because the suit feels so weird, what do you conclude? I felt when everybody said what a nice suit I was wearing that I must be sick. So I went to an analyst. Now, he was wearing another kind of weird suit, see? And what he did was he said that for a pittance, he would teach me how to wear his suit instead of my suit, you see? So I learned how to wear his suit, which had even more status connected. I mean, more people said, beautiful suit. Part of learning how to wear that suit was you didn't see people anymore. You just saw psychosexual stages of development. You saw anal retentives and early phallics and things like that. And I really wasn't very happy in that suit either. In that suit, I was a therapist, and I really needed to be a therapist because I was so identified with my needs at that point that everybody else had to be a potential patient. So, and if you wouldn't be my patient, I didn't have much use for you because I needed to be a therapist full time. So that suit felt weird as well. Well, then, through the kindness of a rather wild Irish fellow, I took off my suits entirely, and I stood naked. An elf, let's put it, a little Irish gnome. I took off my suit and I stood naked, and it felt wonderful, absolutely wonderful. I felt at home, I felt at peace, I felt content. I felt like this is where I had always I knew in my inner being this is where I really was, but somehow I'd never been able to get there. Ever since I'd been born into somebodyness, the somebodyness had always short-shrifted who I was. As my friend pointed out, you have to go out of your mind to use your head. And that what I had been trained in was an ego structure, a conceptual structure that defined who I was and who everybody else was. And most people learn these structures, and they're like huge mind nets that come out of your head. And you walk down the street, and you're somebody. You say, you know who you are. You dress like somebody. Your face looks like somebody. Everything is somebody-ness. This is who I am. 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 This is who you are. This is who you are. And you, everybody is reinforcing their structure of the universe over and over again. And they meet like two huge things meeting. This is who I am. This is who you are. And we enter in these conspiracies. I'll make believe you are who you think you are. If you make believe I am who I think I am. And we just kind of bump against each other like huge schmooze or something. Big mental mind nets that keep walking down the street. You can see them in everybody. I mean, everybody's busy being somebody. Well, so when I got out of my somebodyness, which was very cramped, I mean, it was like a prison to me. I didn't want to go back to prison. It's like you go out and you see the stars and you smell the air, and then they say, okay, chemicals wearing off, back into prison. And you don't want to go. You say, no, no, but you go anyway, and you go back into your suit, and you feel weird again. You feel doubly weird now because you know that that isn't who you are, but you're caught in it. So that starts quite a journey. It did for me anyway, because it started a journey in which my object was to get high, was to get out of my suit. It was to get out of my physical, psychological identities, which felt extremely limited. And I would get incredibly free and high and clear and in love. I'd go to India and I'd sit in the temple or in meditation and I would get so high. I mean, light was pouring out of my head and I was some combination of the pure mind of the Buddha and the heart of the Christ. Which for a Jewish boy is not bad, you know. And I was really like... I'd be out there, you know. And I come back to the States, and I go to visit the family. And my father would say a simple thing like, you got a job. See, and I'd crash. See, and I'd say, can't go home, brings me down. You know? And I began to have a whole list of things that brought me down. I mean, cities brought me down. Money brought me down. Politics brought me down. And I found myself, interestingly enough, wearing a new kind of a suit. It was like, I'm very high. Don't get near me. I'm very high. Okay. Okay. And something felt wrong about it. I mean, I loved being out there in La La Land. I mean, it was, ooh, wow, phew, oh, hmm. I mean, you go out or in or up or down, and there's no space, that's all phony, but you go wherever you go, that's another plane of consciousness, which is right here, actually, and you look around and everybody's mishpacha, everybody's the family, everybody's, that's Sanskrit, that's all right, that's... everybody's sisters or brothers, or if you go out far enough, you look and there's only one of us in drag. I mean, appearing to be many, there's only... And you really see it. You experience the oneness of things. And it's so connected and so beautiful, so that when you come back down into your separateness, the pain is incredible because you once again feel that feeling of being cut off. See, along our way of evolution, we've developed certain powers or siddhis. One of them is this prehensile thing. Then when we got beyond that, we got to these prefrontal lobes. And those give us the choice. We can remember, plan, analyze, cognate. We can be analytic, linear, etc. And that's the major instrument for the spacesuit control mechanism. That allows you to survive on Earth. The problem with the intellect, however, is that it doesn't allow you to escape from dualism. That is, it always thinks about something. So it always takes an object. So as long as you identify with your thinking mind, you are always one thought away from where the action is. You're always thinking about it or looking at it. You're always in that one thought away from life, and you experience that you are cut off by being in your mind. And there is a quality that is starving in an individual that is locked in their mind. So when you move to another plane of consciousness, which is no longer controlled by your intellect, which is really a subsystem, and you move into the meta system, what you feel at that moment is, subjectively in the universe, you feel like you are the universe, or you feel merged with it, or you feel fully in the moment, thick with the moment. And that richness is so fulfilling. It's interesting. It just is. You can be it. The minute you try to know it or experience it, you go back into dualism again. But you can be the thickness of the moment. Now, because I had been so, felt so trapped by my body and my personality and was so unhappy in all of that, my job, it seemed, was to push away those things. And I tried a number of techniques like renunciation. I figured if I just renounced all of it enough, it would go away. All I did was end up a horny celibate. It's like giving up smoking, like I haven't smoked in 4 years, 2 months, 3 days, and 22 minutes. Like, personal die from non-smoking. It didn't work. Because if you push something away, it's still got you. You're busy not doing it. Not doing it. As I look back on the stages now and I see, for example, I used to be identified with my body. I mean, that's who I was. I was this body, which I didn't really care for that much. And I, during that time, I was busy not going bald, for example. It's amazing. I mean, some people are busy not going bald. That's who they are, you know. Like, I had a long piece of hair, and I wore it like this, and, you know, in the wind, you stand like Rodin's The Thinker, you know, like this. And you notice how much hair everybody's got. I mean, it's a whole reality. It's a whole world of, like... I mean, this is like a 55-year-old decaying foot right here. And it's just like if you went out in the woods and you saw an old tree trunk. I mean, if I thought that was my foot, I'd freak. But it's just a nice decaying foot. It's rather attractive. I mean, look at all these veins and these bones, this loose skin. It's kind of, it's getting nice. You know, I have these spots on my head now. And there's this Porcelana ad that says... they call these aging spots, I call them ugly. That was the ad. So. For me, it's they call these ugly, I call them aging spots. Because you begin to appreciate nature even when it's your own body, when you're not so busy taking it so seriously, when you're not so lost in it. It's just decaying just like it's supposed to. You know, one of these days it'll drop away. But then the personality, that was much more seductive. I mean, I really took that seriously for years. Am I happy? Do I have enough space? Are my relationships fulfilling? I mean, I really need to be nurtured. Because I was a motivational psychologist, so that was all real. I taught that it was real. It must have been real. I was saying it at Harvard. It must have been real. It was a complete melodramatic hype, it turned out. I didn't know that. No, you can have it seriously if you want. There's no rush. There's no time, so we'll wait. So you say, what do you mean my personality isn't real? It is real. It's relatively real, and you should... I've had... You know... I've had neuroses. I've had an awful lot of neuroses. I mean, I've had sexual neuroses and emotional, all kinds of motivational neuroses. And I've been through analysis. I took drugs for years. I've been to my guru. I've done spiritual practices. I haven't lost one neurosis in all that time. Not one. The only thing that's changed is that they used to be these big neuroses, and now they're these like little schmooze. See that, hi, come on in, have tea. They're like old friendly neuroses, like, will they like me? That's a good one. See? Hi, come on in, you know. I can line them up. They're like the children, you know, for a family photograph. All my little neuroses sitting here, they're all right here. Okay. I've become really quite fond of them, actually. And I look at all the spiritual teachers and all the great saints, and they're all terribly neurotic. I mean, it's just like I'm not going to grow hair if I get really free, probably. So I think my neuroses are just my style now. See, they give me style. Well, that's what flips. The dramas are still there, the desires and the needs. You just don't take them so seriously. You don't, I need this. It's like, I'm depressed. You're really depressed? Yeah, I'm depressed. You're completely depressed? Yes, I'm completely depressed. Every bit of you, oh boy, am I depressed. Oh. Any part of you not depressed? No. Completely depressed. Are you noticing your depression? Yes. Tell me, is the noticer depressed? Well, a notice is just noticing. Aha. See, and after a while, you get so that you climb into the noticer more frequently because you know the depression is just a thing that comes and goes. Or try boredom, for example. That's a great one. Everybody buys into that. I'm bored. What am I going to do? Call somebody, turn on the television, read a book, do something. My God, I'm bored. You don't have to be bored. There's so much to do. Things to think about. Listen to the news. See, those are all melodramas, and you milk them. We trip out on ourselves so much. There's nothing wrong with being bored. I'm bored. Nothing's ever going to happen again. See, nothing is. That's what's so funny. People say to me, this is a really heavy tour you're doing. You're traveling, you're doing 60 cities. It must be exhausting. It's funny. I didn't notice I was doing anything. I'm just sitting here. The plane does the flying. I don't, you know. I just come, I do. I look at somebody that's raising 3 kids, and I think, oh, my God. Yeah. See, after you end tripping, and that's the thing, it dies hard, I'll tell you, because you want to milk it just once more. I mean, you can get just a little more juice out of it, just a little more. Because we've all been grown up so much with the myths of this culture that more is better. And that just another one will be just a little bit more. I mean, ice cream is good, but in those great big cones that are made of that special, like waffles. Oh, God. And have you tried that ice cream shop that's over? You got to go 40 miles, but it's worth it. We're living in the yuppie paradise of more is better. And we keep dramatizing it. I need this to be happy. Then there comes a time when all the trips start to seem empty to you. I mean, you're going to buy a new car, and you get it, and you get into it, and you really want to milk the feeling of a new car. You drive down the street, and you're looking to see if anybody's looking, and you feel that power. Wow. Boy, the transmission's beautiful. And boy, oh boy. And you just, wow. And then a few minutes later, the first squeak, or the next payment. Until finally, even as you're about to reach for it, it's already empty. Yeah, yeah. You'll go through it, don't worry, don't complain. You've just begun. And it gets scary because you based your life on collecting things. I've collected stuff. I kept collecting things. In fact, I had boxes of things. You have attics, but I'm a wandering monk, see? So I have to keep it in boxes. So I'm a sadhu. And my guru was known at one stage as Crackpot Baba. He was naked, and all he would pick up pieces of cracked pot and put them on his head. And then when he needed water, he'd use it for water and throw it away. And I'm in that lineage, so as soon as I get rid of my Master Charge and my Volvo and things like that, I'll be right behind him. But my problem is that I have not only the Master Charge and the Volvo, but I had all these boxes of memorabilia that I couldn't bear to be parted from. I mean, old letters from the 60s and love letters and pictures of people you're never going to see again. And I'd keep putting them in boxes, which I never opened because life was so rich. See, but I'd label them. And then every time I'd move, I would be this wandering sadhu, but behind me would be a UPS truck with all my with my personal history, you know. And then I got to the point where I thought, gee, I haven't opened these in about 10 years. I just keep adding to them. Why am I carrying them? I guess I assume I'm going to run out of the here and now. And later, when it's all horrible, I'll be able to open them and say, remember that time at the Grand Canyon? Wow, look at that. Who was that? You remember that high school? But all it seemed was that life was getting richer and richer. Not through trippiness, but just through simplicity. So I decided to throw them all away. So I put them out in the dump. But during the night, I was out in the dump. Because I thought, oh my, I thought of something I was never going to see again, and I couldn't bear it, so I was going. So I thought I'd better burn them. So I had a big fire, and I burned, out of 15 boxes, I burned about 9 of them. The other 6 I wasn't ready for yet. Now I have maybe 9. So, at any rate, I kept trying to get high all the time to get rid of all this trippiness because it all seemed so finite. And I felt something was wrong about the direction I was going because everybody else was sort of doing the same thing in the 60s, early 70s. I kept hearing the messages in the spiritual teachings, there's nowhere to stand. But I kept refuting it in my mind because I still wanted to stand out there looking back down. It was so safe. It was so free of any emotional pain. And a lot of people get high in order to get out of emotional pain. It slowly has been dawning on me over the past 8-10 years. That the game wasn't to be high, the game was to be free. And that free meant you couldn't push anything away and you couldn't grab at anything. There was nowhere to stand. And there was nowhere not to stand. And that I was, whatever this incarnation, whatever level of reality this was, I had to inhabit it impeccably to be free within it. And that freedom was going to come through my incarnation, not in spite of it. And that I was going to have to learn to be, as Christ said, in the world, but not of the world. And that all the things I'd pushed away, I was going to have to take the curriculum sooner or later. That turned around the direction of my life a lot. Because until that time, when I was busy just trying to get high to get enlightened, and I thought enlightened was high, that was a confusion in my mind. During that time, I really begrudged the price of living on the earth. I begrudged, and I constantly saw that I wanted to push away all the experiences of life. It's interesting, when you want to get high, suffering is a real drag, and you want to avoid suffering as hard as you can. When you want to be free, you begin to hear the teachings of the Buddha about the cause of suffering being the clinging of the mind. And when something creates suffering in you, you don't go asking for it unless you're really advanced, I guess, but when the suffering comes down the pike, you don't turn away from it because you know that the only reason you're suffering is it's telling you something about the clinging of your own mind. And it's being offered to you as a gift. This gets very weird because it turns the whole game around. As Rumi says, at first, before you're awakened, you go towards water and you avoid fire. After you begin to awaken, you go towards fire and that brings you into the cooling quality of the water. That instead of going for pleasure, you go for freedom. And it's a very different style of life. And a lot of things that you would have avoided because they brought you down, because you see that the only thing that brings you down is your own mind. It's not the city. The city's just sitting itself. It's being essence city. What are you getting so upset about? It's your reaction to the city that's what's doing it to you. And so, like the other night I was in Des Moines, Iowa, and I came into the hall in the evening, and there were people waiting around front to... And they said, there's Ram Dass. And see, I'm like a rent to Ram Dass. I have no idea who I am, and I don't even care. I mean, I'm just an awareness, and I do what I got to do. So since I don't know who I am, as people project into me, I become what their projection is a lot of the time. Somebody says, Ram Dass. And I go, yes. You know, it's like... if somebody says, hi, Dick, I say, hi. I don't care. See, if you're somebody and they go, hi, Dick, you say, yes, you see, and it doesn't work. So I came to the hall and everybody was Ram Dass, and I was, yes, yes, and I was smiling, and I was being Ram Dass. You know, that's it's a nice role. I'm not anybody. What the difference does it make to me? I mean, I'm not all those things. It's not like I'm phony. See, it's not like I'm being somebody else back in there. It's not that. It's just a form. We're all in forms. We can't meet except through forms. We don't have to get lost in them. Who will we be this time? Well, I'll be serious. Okay, I'll be light. So I came in the hall, and I was being sweet and loving, and every evening I always ask for a mini boom microphone. That's one of these things. Because when you're sitting cross-legged, if you have a straight mic, you got to spend the whole evening leaning forward like that. So I asked for this, and I walked into the hall, and there was a straight microphone. And I was all smiling, and I suddenly said, what's that? And the woman was the manager of the hall, said, well, that's the only microphone we had. And I said, well, we advised you we needed a microphone. And I started to get into this curmudgeon-y, ooh, yick, and I broke up completely. I mean, I just saw myself get completely ugly, and I broke up because what I saw was that my guru had come in drag as a microphone to say, oh, you think you're so high and mighty, you know, try this one on for size. It's interesting that as long as you identify with your personality, the things that get you uptight are your enemies. The minute you identify with your awareness, then the things that get you uptight show you where your awareness has still sticky fingers. All of the spiritual practices that one does primarily are designed to help release you from the tyranny of your own analytic mind. Sometimes you use the mind to beat the mind. Sometimes you do it through devotion. Sometimes you do it through working with energies like breath and so on. And the minute you break the identification with your thought, it's as if you come into a quality of awareness that also, besides the quality that it has of presence and clarity about the universe around you, or in you, or you, there is also a quality that is very soft in it. I focus for that, or I see that as what's called in Chinese the sin-sin, H-S-I-N, sin-sin, the heart-mind. It's the intuitive heart. It's not the emotional heart. It is the like the doorway into that other realm where you are not separate. Like the quality of our emotional heart is like a doorway into that. You notice how with your heart goes out to people. My heart goes out to you is an expression. You give away anything. Take my car, take my house, take it all, the heart says. The mind keeps saying, now, wait a minute. Okay? Because the mind is protecting your separateness while the heart is giving it all away, always. And the interesting situation is that we all have these incredibly compassionate hearts that are like, they are the quality of love, the quality of boundaryless, soft, merging presence. But most of us armor our hearts with our mind, with our thought. And the only thing that we're involved in at this moment in our practices then is breaking down that armor so that that intuitive heart can function, because we've cut ourselves off from it by our mind armoring us. And when we do that, we end up feeling starved, because it's through that intuitive heart that we actually get fed by the universe. It's like an umbilical cord of stuff that comes into us. And when we cut it off with the mind, we end up feeling very alienated and very starved. And that's why we're always so greedy. We keep wanting more of everything because we're always trying to fulfill a hunger in us. And the hunger is created by the way in which we've made ourselves, reinforced our own separateness from it all. And you can see all the pathology in the way we've gotten rid of the extended family and we've gotten the mobility. We've taught about external freedom, meaning you don't have to be attached to anything. And the cost is incredible. The paradoxes that I've been working with, some of them revolve around the issue of suffering and pain. See, most of us, with your mind, because your mind lives, deals with polarities, you feel that if you're happy, you're not sad. And you want to be happy, so you push away that which makes you sad. I've described the image in many lectures of standing in Marin County with a frisbee, about to throw a frisbee. And through my mind went the inscription over Gandhi's tomb, which says, "Think of the poorest person you have ever seen and ask whether your next act will be of any use." See, do you throw the frisbee or don't you? That's the issue of an affluent culture. Can you not throw the frisbee because the fact that a baby's dying every 45 seconds? But if you don't ever throw the frisbee, what is it you're offering the baby? I mean, how do you hear how to deal with suffering? And I've begun to understand that what is required is that we expand ourselves to embrace all of the planes of consciousness simultaneously for true compassion to arise. If you alter your consciousness sufficiently so that you're standing at the cusp between form and formless, right at the edge, and you look out at form, you are absolutely awed by the beauty, the exquisiteness, the awesome nature of the way in which forms are all related lawfully. Plato refers to that. He talks about seeing the law and praising God as the law. He said, but in order to do that, you can't be identified with your own suffering or your own pleasure, or you don't see it. It's the same thing the Tao says when it says, truth waits for eyes unclouded by longing. If you want something, or if you're pushing something away, you don't see this beauty. It's only when you develop a certain equanimity and a certain emptiness inside, when you're right at the edge of the formless, that you look at the forms and you see the law, and it is so beautiful. I mean, we see it in all these little microcosms. We see it in physics and astronomy and the way in which a cell structure is related to the way the planets work and the lawful nature of music and art. And it is... And you look and you see that your own thinking mind is part of that law. And it's all unfolding in a purely lawful way. And then you look and you see that the suffering in the universe, if you stand back far enough, that the suffering is part of the law. There are, from where I'm sitting, when I'm sitting in that place, there are no errors in the universe, not one. That where you are at this moment, with all your sorrows, with all your problems, with all the things of all your if-onlys, if-onlys, just where you are at this moment is the absolutely optimum place you are to be at this moment from a spiritual point of view for your optimum growth. And the statement in you, I should be more like the Buddha or the Christ, or I wish I was there, or I should be meditating more, or all that, that's all part of the perfection. And you look and you see that the way in which suffering works, in the way it works from a spiritual point of view. But then when you identify with your humanness, with your separateness, with your emotional heart, suffering stinks. And when you look at the pain of another human being, it wipes you out because you empathize with it. And you feel so horrible about their pain. And you would do anything to take it away. And the problem is there's so much of it. I mean, there's battered mothers and battered children, and there's starving beings, and there's blind people, and there's whales that are going extinct, and there's seals, and there's trees, and there's... Where do you begin? You just got to look in a mirror. There's suffering right there. And it's so much for the human heart that the human heart armors itself with the mind, and you become what's known in the service industry, in the caring industry, as professionally warm. You are kind in a way that doesn't hurt your heart. You're caring. Like if you're a nurse working in an ICU ward and you're dealing with pain and fear and suffering and death, most of those people become very kind and warm and friendly and caring, but they are protecting. They have cut off their own hearts because they feel they would break otherwise. And they got to save something for home. But if you are going to be free, there's nothing you can turn away from or turn off. And how do you keep your heart open in hell becomes the interesting question. The best way I can understand it now is that it is the balancing of these planes of reality inside myself that allows me to do that. It's interesting that as you extricate yourself from your identification with your separateness, your whole feeling about death changes. Because the part of you that isn't separate isn't coming and it isn't going and there's no birth and there's no death, you just are. But because that part of you is not knowable by your mind keeps denying its existence. The part of you that is not in form is only beable. It's not knowable. And the mind goes up the wall trying to figure out how to control that part of you. And for us to stretch to handle what seems like a paradox to the mind, that it's all perfect and it's horrible, that there's nothing to do really, so get on with it, that it is all empty. And when you embrace all of it, you start to embrace the human condition into yourself. You start to embrace the suffering. Like if you live fully in this moment, does this moment include that baby that's taking its last breath from starvation? Yeah. So are you sad? Yes. Does it include the baby taking its first breath as it comes out of its mother's womb? And the joy of the beginning? Yes. So you're happy. If you are the fullness of the moment, all of it, these are all your voices. The cry. There's a beautiful poem by Thich Nhat Hanh. He says, among other things, I won't read the whole thing. He says, I am the mayfly metamorphizing on the surface of the river. I am also the bird which, when spring comes, arrives in time to eat the mayfly. I am a frog swimming happily in the clear water of a pond. I am also the grass snake who, approaching in silence, feeds itself on the frog. I am the child in Uganda, all skin and bones, my legs as thin as bamboo sticks. I am also the merchant of arms selling deadly weapons to Uganda. I am the 12-year-old girl, refugee on a small boat, who throws herself into the ocean after being raped by a sea pirate. I am also the pirate, my heart not yet capable of seeing and loving. My joy is like spring, so warm it makes flowers bloom in all walks of life. My pain is like a river of tears, so full it fills up all the four oceans. Please call me by my correct names so that I can hear at the same time all my cries and all my laughs, so that I could see that my joy and pain are but one. Please call me by my correct names so that I could become awake, so that the door of my heart be left open, the door of compassion. If you and I are to be free, there is nothing we can push away. And when we die into all of it, and we get out of the egocentric predicament, Gandhi, God demands nothing less than complete self-surrender as the price for the only real freedom that is worth having. Meaning you stop being so busy being you. And when a person thus loses herself, she immediately finds herself in the service of all that lives. It becomes her delight and recreation. She is a new person, never weary of spending herself in the service of God's creation. It's interesting that when you have extricated yourself from your own egocentric predicament, and when you have tasted the emptiness of all forms, then your action comes out of the collective quality of the situation, and the suffering of another person is something you do not because I'm helping you, but because it is healing itself. And you're not collecting points for it. You are merely tuning yourself to being part of the harmony of things. You're being part of the way of things. It's like you're dying into the perfection of it all, which includes the beauty of your mind. But it's the servant, it's available, but you are no longer trapped inside of it. It's just the subtlest flip in where you are in relation to who you are. Before you identified with the clouds, now you understand that you are the sky and the clouds. As you extricate yourself from your somebodyness, from your thoughts, which are things, from your body, which is things or stuff. Who you are has no time, has no space. It's not here, it's here. Hakuin, the Zen poet, says, your coming and going is nowhere but where you are. You're always right here. Where are you going to go? Ramana Maharshi was dying, the beautiful saint, and all his devotees were crying, don't leave us, don't leave us. And he said, don't be silly, where could I go? It's like I'm just selling the Ford. It's no big deal. With that quietness comes a way of being in the universe. It's what Heinlein calls grokking. It's like you are part, you are one with it all. So that the action that you perform as a separate entity arises out of the collective wisdom of the situation rather than doing it in an angular way, cut off from everything. You start to trust your intuitive heart. Very interesting to start to live that way. You don't have to figure it all out. You start to trust that place. It doesn't mean you're anti-intellectual. Your mind is a beautiful tool. It's wonderful. It's just not a trap. And under those conditions, you start to become responsive to the world around you rather than reactive. Because your mind is part of law, it's all cause and effect, and it's all reactive. The minute you're in that awareness behind it, you're free, and you hear it all, and out of it comes that which is suitable to bring things back into harmony. Let me read you this one story from How Can I Help?, this wonderful book by Ram Dass and Paul Gorman. It really is good. It's got a lot of good stories in it, and this is one of them. It's a story about told to me by a friend of mine who's an Aikido master. His name is Terry Dobson. The train clanked and rattled through the suburbs of Tokyo on a drowsy spring afternoon. Our car was comparatively empty, a few housewives with their kids in tow, some old folks going shopping. I gazed absently at the drab houses and dusty hedgerows. At one station, the doors opened, and suddenly the afternoon quiet was shattered by a man bellowing violent, incomprehensible curses. The man staggered into our car. He wore labor's clothing, and he was big, drunk, and dirty. Screaming, he swung at a woman holding a baby. The blow sent her spinning into the laps of an elderly couple. It was a miracle that the baby was unharmed. Terrified, the couple jumped up and scrambled towards the other end of the car. The laborer aimed a kick at the retreating back of the old woman, but missed as she scuttled to safety. This so enraged the drunk that he grabbed the metal pole in the center of the car and tried to wrench it out of its stanchion. I could see that one of his hands was cut and bleeding. The train lurched ahead, the passengers frozen with fear. I stood up. I was young then, some 20 years ago, and in pretty good shape. I had been putting in a solid 8 hours of Aikido training nearly every day for the past 3 years. I liked to throw and grapple. I thought I was tough. The trouble was, my martial skill was untested in actual combat. As students of Aikido, we were not allowed to fight. Aikido, my teacher had said again and again, is the art of reconciliation. Whoever has the mind to fight has broken his connection with the universe. If you try to dominate people, you're already defeated. We study how to resolve conflict, not how to start it. I listened to his words. I tried hard. I even crossed the street to avoid the pinball punks who lounged around the train station. My forbearance exalted me. I felt both tough and holy. In my heart, however, I wanted an absolutely legitimate opportunity whereby I might save the innocent by destroying the guilty. This is it, I said to myself as I got to my feet. People are in danger. If I don't do something fast, somebody will probably get hurt. Seeing me stand up, the drunk recognized a chance to focus his rage. Aha! He roared. A foreigner! You need a lesson in Japanese manners! I held on lightly to the commuter strap overhead and gave him a slow look of disgust and dismissal. I planned to take this turkey apart, but he had to make the first move. I wanted him mad, so I pursed my lips and blew him an insolent kiss. All right, he hollered. You're gonna get a lesson. He gathered himself for a rush at me. A fraction of a second before he could move, someone shouted, Hey! It was ear-splitting. I remember the strangely joyous, lilting quality of it, as though you and a friend had been searching diligently for something and he had suddenly stumbled upon it. Hey! I wheeled to my left, the drunk spun to his right, we both stared down at a little old Japanese man. He must have been well into his 70s, this tiny gentleman, sitting there immaculate in his kimono. He took no notice of me, but beamed delightedly at the laborer, as though he had a most important, most welcome secret to share. Come here and talk to me, he motioned to the old man. The big man followed as if on a string. He planted his feet belligerently in front of the old gentleman and roared above the clacking wheels, Why the hell should I talk to you? The drunk now had his back to me. If his elbow moved so much as a millimeter, I'd drop him in his socks. The old man continued to beam at the laborer. What you been drinking? He asked, his eyes sparkling with interest. I've been drinking sake, and it's none of your business. Flecks of spittle spattered the old man. Oh, that's wonderful, the old man said. Absolutely wonderful. You see, I love sake, too. Every evening, me and my wife, she's 76, you know, we take our bottle of warm sake and we go out and sit on the wooden bench. We watch to see how our persimmon tree is doing. My grandfather planted that tree. We've been very concerned after those ice storms we had last winter. But you know, it's done better than we expected, especially when you consider the poor quality of the soil. And we take our sake even when it rains. He looked up at the laborer, his eyes twinkling. As he struggled to follow the old man's conversation, the drunk's face began to soften. His fists slowly unclenched. "Yeah," he said, "I love persimmons too." His voice trailed off. "Yes," said the old man, smiling, "and I'm sure you have a wonderful wife." "No," replied the laborer, "my wife died." Very gently, swaying with the motion of the train, the big man began to sob. "I don't got no wife. I don't got no home. I don't got no job. I'm so ashamed of myself." Tears rolled down his cheeks. A spasm of despair rippled through his body. Now it was my turn. Standing there in my well-scrubbed youthful innocence, my make this world safe for democracy righteousness, I suddenly felt dirtier than he was. Then the train arrived at my stop. As the door opened, I heard the old man cluck sympathetically. "My, my," he said, "that is a difficult predicament indeed. Sit down here and tell me about it." I turned my head for one last look. The laborer was sprawled on the seat, his head in the old man's lap. The old man was softly stroking the filthy, matted hair. As the train pulled away, I sat down on a bench. What I had wanted to do with muscle had been accomplished with love. I had just seen Aikido in combat.
God only knows And in the end, it's only round and round, round and round, round and round, round. Haven't you heard? It's a battle of words. Most of them are right. Listen, son, said the man.
It comes.